This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll discuss one of the most pressing issues of the day, the killing of innocent civilians in the Middle East.
Completely illegal war by Israel in Lebanon and Gaza Strip. Why? What's going on?
A war pre-planned by Israel and the United States, and a war illegal under certain American laws, providing that the United States shouldn't be sending the kind of weapons they are to Israel and for what Israel's doing with them.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Well, this week we've had some really disturbing news about Fidel Castro becoming ill. He's almost 80 years old, and he apparently had an operation that caused him to go into the hospital. And as allowed under Cuban law, like it is in other countries, he turned over, at least temporarily, many of his powers of state as the head of the Cuban Communist Party, as well as the prime minister, to Raul and other posts to other people. But it's really disturbing, as our listeners, I'm sure, know that the revolution succeeded in 1959. Fidel has been really the heart and soul of that revolution since that time. The accomplishments have been great. And of course, the onslaught against the Cuban Revolution, particularly from the United States, has been horrific. And it continues, of course, as of course many of our listeners know, with the case of the Cuban Five and many, many other ways. And I'm here with Michael Smith, really, to talk about this circumstance, of course, for us, for Michael and I. The Cuban Revolution really was, in many ways, the anvil of our political existence. It was what we were about, really, in the 60s and the 70s as we went forward with our lives.
And it's shown to the world that another way is possible. And I think that's what really gets under the skin of the people that run the United States. And that's what they want to overturn. They want to restore private property to Cuba. They want to take away the planned economic system that Cuba has. Right now, because of the surplus that the Cuban economy generates, they've got some of the best health care in the world, some of the best education in the world. People in Cuba are poor. It's in a lot of ways a third world country, but it's also in a lot of ways an extremely cultured, wonderful place. This matters not a whit to the vultures in Miami who are dancing in the streets over the thought of Castro dying a painful and quick death. In contrast, say, to our President Bush, who also, by the way, if he was temporarily ill, would hand over power to Cheney under our system. And they've got this, they've got a constitution in Cuba. They've got elections in Cuba. They've got a parliament in Cuba. None of this comes out. Instead, you have the Post and the Daily News screaming dictator. The fact that Cuba has a system of law, the fact that Cuba, in the teeth of the American blockade, has made all these terrific economic gains, none of that's talked about. And instead, all you talk about is how the United States is going to help restore, quote, democracy to Cuba, just like they helped restore democracy to Iraq.
Now, what we'll be seeing in Cuba, I fear, is if the U.S. gets its way, but I don't fear that the Cubans are just going to give in as easily as the Miami Cubans think, is if, I don't know if any of our listeners have ever seen or read about the favelas you see in Brazil and in other places in South America, where rampant capitalism took over under the guise of the United States, and you have 5 million poor street kids running around in Rio de Janeiro being shot by cops. You don't see that in Cuba. I'm convinced that had there not been a Cuban revolution, you would see that in Cuba. You would see those kind of slums, which I remember when I used to go to Cuba, they used to show me at the edge of the revolution, huge slums that existed right after the takeover. And what you do is when you judge a society, in my view, and that's why I hate the judgments around Cuba, I judge it by a number of things. One of them is how children are treated, and particularly around issues that Michael has been discussing, health care, education, and housing. And after that, I'm willing to talk to you about other things. But to me, a society has to provide those three aspects, economic and those solid economic rights to its population that's growing. And we don't even do that in the United States. And Cuba came in and Fidel Castro came into power, the revolution, that those three aspects of life were going to be provided. And they succeeded in that.
Sure. Because in those days, your average Cuban had no shoes, worked from can't see in the morning to can't see at night on a sugar plantation owned by an American corporation, worked part-time, seasonal, was uneducated and illiterate and ill and died at the age of 38. That was back in 58. All that's changed. You got a better chance of living a long life in Cuba now, say, than in Harlem. All that's changed. And it was changed by Fidel, a small group of guerrilla warriors in the hills, backed by huge numbers of Cubans in the cities. A genuine popular revolution. The United States supported the dictator Batista against them. Some 20,000 people were killed in the course of the Cuban Revolution. They restored a democratic constitution to Cuba. The first step they took, and this was interesting because Fidel was a privileged person, like, say, Bush, he came from a well-to-do family. His father was a large landowner in Cuba. And the first thing the Cuban Revolution did was they had a land reform. And these shoeless peasants that were working long hours for very little and dying young now had a chance to own their own land. And the United States went crazy because they were the ones that were the victims, the American owners.
And they actually
took
over Fidel's mother's plantation.
That was the first one. The United States went crazy and said, you can't do this. And the Cubans said, under our law and international law, we certainly can, and we'll compensate anybody whose property is nationalized, and we'll compensate them at the rate that they listed the property was worth for the purpose of paying taxes in Cuba. That didn't go down. The United States retaliated after the land reform. The thing escalated. The Cuban government wound up nationalizing the phone company and the nickel company and the tobacco fields, and that's what we call Cuban socialism, so that the economy was run for the benefit of the Cuban people and not for the benefit of foreign owners. That's what the people in Miami want to get back. That's what the Bush administration and their recent plan that they developed and published wants to do. They want to restore private property and imperialism to Cuba, and that's the struggle.
And we'll see what happens. You'll see a lot of people become well off, but you'll also see a population that becomes quite, quite impoverished if that happens. We see two things frequently. One is everybody predicting the death of Fidel, and they've been doing that for 20, 30, 40 years, apart from them trying to kill him themselves with, you know, exploding cigars and everything else. So I don't think we're ready to see that right now, for one. And secondly, people like, sure, Fidel in some way embodies the revolution. He isn't the revolution. There's a strong Communist Party. There's strong popular support for the revolution. I just don't see that one day Fidel dies and the next day a Miami guy in gold chains and a Cadillac comes into Cuba and starts running the Havana Libre and changing the name to the Hilton. That is not going to happen. I don't think we're going to see that very quickly.
I think that's the fantasy of the Miami exiles. They thought that was going to happen with the Bay of Pigs, you remember. And the Bay of Pigs was an utter disaster.
Can you just see it, though, Michael? Think about yourself. If you were a Miami Cuban, the Malecón McDonald's.
The United States supplies Israel with some of the most sophisticated and exotic weaponry to slaughter Lebanese and Palestinian civilians. This is in violation of the U.S. Arms Export Control Act, a law that requires military items such as bombs that are transferred to foreign governments by the United States to be used for internal security and legitimate self-defense. We'll talk more about this with our next guest, Marjorie Cohen. Marjorie is the incoming president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She writes for Common Dreams, for Counterpunch, and we're very happy to have her on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder, Marjorie.
Thank you, Heidi. It's good to be here.
Marjorie, the Bush administration talks about Iran and Syria helping to arm Hezbollah. What is the U.S. involvement in this war?
Well, the United States is arming Israel to the teeth. When Israel put out an SOS to rush over several more bombs, the U.S. sent a batch of replacement smart bombs, so-called smart bombs. They're supposed to be smart enough to distinguish between civilians and military, and emergency jet fuel. And the New York Times said that the decision to quickly ship the weapons to Israel was made with relatively little debate within the Bush administration. The Bush administration gives the government of Israel tremendous support, military support. This is in violation of the Foreign Assistance Act, which prohibits the United States from giving assistance to the government of any country that engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights, and also in violation of the U.S. Arms Export Control Act. But in terms of Syria and Iran, Bush is really hoping that Israel will bring Iran and Syria into this conflict. It's really astounding to think that's true, but it is. And an article in a recent edition of the Jerusalem Post said that Israel doesn't want to attack Syria, but the article ends up saying that the head of the Defense Forces said that the United States wants Israel to attack Syria. And this is in the Jerusalem Post. And indeed, Israel has been bombing roads between Lebanon and Syria, and Syria is putting its military on high alert. Seymour Hersh documented preparations by the Air Force and the U.S. Strategic Command for a war with Iran. So it really looks like Bush wants to make his so-called new Middle East include regime change, not just in Iraq, not just what's happening in Lebanon, but also in Iran and Syria.
Does the U.S. have the capability to do that? I was a little bit shocked that America was rushing emergency jet fuel and bombs to Israel, because Israel has one of the largest military operations in the world.
Fourth, Dahlia. Fourth in the world.
During the Bush administration, the Bush II administration from 2001 to 2005, Israel received from the United States $10.5 billion in foreign military financing. That's the Pentagon's biggest military aid program, and $6.3 billion in U.S. arms delivery.
They ran out of arms and they needed more?
They needed more. And, you know, one of the types of arms that the U.S. sent over are bunker buster bombs with depleted uranium on them. This is a poisonous weapon, like the use of cluster bombs, which Israel is also using.
Yeah, where are they?
U.S. made cluster bombs.
I was going to say they're U.S. made cluster
bombs. U.S. made cluster bombs. Those are war crimes. Right now, there's a trial going on in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague, and they are alleging that attacks with cluster bombs in the former Yugoslavia constitutes war crimes. And, you know, Robert Fisk was interviewed by Amy Goodman, and this is very interesting. I just want to read this really quickly, because Robert Fisk went over to Kana to assess the damage and the deaths there after this horrible bombing on Sunday. And he said, this is Robert Fisk, who's lived in Lebanon, in Beirut, for three decades. He said, "I saw this very beautiful young woman lying in bed, and her skin had been pitted with very familiar wounds, the little tiny round crimson holes of cluster bombs. We used cluster bombs in Iraq in 2003. I know exactly what the wounds look like. I identified them at once. Indeed, she described the cluster bombs falling like grapes, as she put it, out of the sky, oddly enough, an expression used by an Iraqi woman in 2003 to me." That's what we are doing. That's what we're helping Israel do to the Lebanese people.
For those who don't know, can you explain what a cluster bomb is?
A cluster bomb is a bomb that, when it falls, explodes into tiny bomblets, and these bomblets, like grapes falling from the sky, penetrate a very, very wide swath of area. One of the problems with cluster bombs, in addition to the tremendous damage and the fact that civilians are often killed and wounded because they can't pinpoint their target, is that cluster bombs often don't explode. There's a high rate of them not exploding, and so they lie around. They look like Coca-Cola cans. They look very attractive to young children. Young children often pick them up, and they explode in their hands, killing them, sometimes wounding them, and they lose limbs. We have used cluster bombs in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and also the U.S. led NATO bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999.
Marjorie, Hillary Clinton, our senator and presidential hopeful, the warrior princess, said that what the United States is doing over there is what Israel is doing is in defense of American values. She was able to say that without any irony.
To the credit of a candidate who's running against Hillary Clinton, Jonathan Tessini, he came out really strongly against the war that Israel is now waging against Lebanon. I mean, it was a terrific statement.
You know, that takes tremendous courage, because if you look at the two resolutions that were passed by Congress, both houses of Congress, with only 8 people in the House of Representatives who did not vote in favor, was a statement that Israel was acting in self-defense, that they commended Israel for its restraint and its care not to injure civilians. Neither condemned what Israel is doing at all in Lebanon, and neither of them called for a ceasefire.
Well, that's the question we want to ask you in terms of how this thing started. Israel's position, of course, is that it's defending itself from rocket attacks from Lebanon. But can you give us some background to that?
Well, this goes back before the 2 soldiers were captured by Hezbollah, and that is 2 border skirmishes between Lebanon and Israel have gone on for 6 years since Israel pulled out of Lebanon. Usually what happens is that there are border skirmishes, which is what this was. This was not an act of war. This was a border skirmish when Hezbollah captured the 2 Israeli soldiers. And what has typically happened before was that there was negotiation and a prisoner swap. And that is exactly what Hezbollah thought would happen. That's what Nasrallah, who is the head of Hezbollah, said for a few months before that. And yet, the Olmert government in Israel, of course, prodded by the United States, used that border skirmish, used the capture of the Israeli soldiers, which was illegal, by the way, but was not a provocation for Israel to come back with overwhelming military force, killing over 600 civilians so far, wounding more than 1,000. It's disproportionate force, and it is not self-defense.
So this was a pretext.
It was a pretext, precisely. It was an excuse. And we are constantly told every time there is any mention of Hezbollah on the media, at least I've tried to watch as much of it as I could, and I'm not just talking about Fox News. Hmm. Anytime there's mention of Hezbollah, it's called a terrorist group. It's called the initiator of this war. Israel's acting in self-defense. You know, you have, once again, the corporate media, really the mouthpiece for the Bush administration, very much like it's been throughout the Iraq War, in leading up to the Iraq War and throughout the Iraq War.
So what do you think the objectives are of both Israel and its enabler, the United States, in this war?
Israel, Olmert is trying to show that he's a tough military guy. He does not have the experience that Sharon had. I am not a biblical scholar, but I suspect that the government of Israel is reading the Old Testament, which is not necessarily the only way to read it, I understand, that anyone who threatens Israel or who, and this is true in the Palestinian, occupied Palestinian territories as well, that, you know, God said to the Jews, go in and destroy everybody who's not Jewish and take it over, and if you don't, you're going to be dispersed throughout the world, but then you'll come back. And I think that that's the basis. There was a very interesting piece that I read that came from a group of, I think, 500,000 Israeli settlers who said civilian casualties on the other side are okay. There's nothing wrong with that, because basically, you know, we're doing our civilians, of course, need to be protected, but not anyone else's.
That's right, in line with Bolton.
It is. Well, Bolton said, and Olmert said this as well, that, you know, an Israeli life is worth more. This is what they said in so many words, than a Palestinian or a Lebanese life. And this is the basis that they're operating on. Now, in terms of the United States government, Bush is very heavily influenced by the neoconservatives and also the Christian Zionists. And the way the Christian Zionists read the New Testament is that Jesus is not going to come back until the temple in Jerusalem is rebuilt. That means it has to stay in Jewish hands so that the Jews can rebuild it, and then they'll convert all the Jews to Christianity. I don't think Jewish people in this country understand that. I think that they think the United States government is supporting Israel because they like Jews. I don't think that's true at all. I think, in fact, it's a very anti-Semitic position. And I think that, you know, in Mel Gibson's Drunken Stupor, I think this actually came out. That's where he's coming from. And he actually didn't have the inhibitions to keep from saying, I think, what a lot of these people are thinking. And so I think that it's really a question of building this so-called new Middle East where, and from the neoconservative perspective, they want the U.S. to have hegemony over the whole region. That's why they kicked Saddam Hussein out, not because he was such a tyrant. That has not bothered us before. We've often supported tyrants. But because
and
he
him.
Was not
we supported
sympathetic.
Him.
Pardon me?
And him. We supported him.
We supported him, exactly. But by kicking him out of power and installing a so-called U.S.-friendly government, although it's you know, making noises now in support of the Lebanese, which is, you know, not to the liking of the Bush administration, but by kicking out Saddam Hussein and putting in this puppet government in Iraq, we are now building 6 to 14 permanent military bases. We were able to move our troops out of Saudi Arabia, which was one of Osama bin Laden's pet peeves. He didn't like U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia near the holy sites of Mecca and Medina. And then by neutralizing Iran and Syria, the only two Arab countries that only two remaining Arab countries that do not salute and march to the U.S. agenda, we can have hegemony over that whole oil-rich region as a counterweight to any influence from China or Russia. So it's political, it's religious, and it's very dangerous.
Marjorie, why is so much attention focused on Condoleezza Rice? And why, in your recent op-ed, did you say that Bush could stop the war with a snap of his fingers?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Condoleezza Rice, if it were, and I'm not saying that prior U.S. governments have had wonderful policies toward Israel, but at least they've gone through the motions. Clinton went through the motions of trying to create some peace. But here you have Bush and Condoleezza Rice and Bolton, you know, the triumvirate, I guess you would say the axis of evil, very, very clear that Israel has to continue to do as much damage as possible to, they say Hezbollah, but it's really the Lebanese people, before there's a ceasefire. They are resisting peace. They're resisting a ceasefire. Condoleezza Rice went over to Lebanon the first time she went over there before the Qana massacre, when the prime minister of Lebanon said, don't bother to come back. But she went over, and the Bush government framed that as an important show of support for the Lebanese people and the Signora government, you know, and the fact that we're even going right into Beirut after all that's happened, that's a pretty dramatic signal. Well, it would have been a lot more dramatic for her to call for a ceasefire. But Bush could stop Israel in its tracks if he wanted to, but he wouldn't, because Israel is doing Bush's bidding, redrawing the map of the Middle East to facilitate U.S. domination. Bush began that task with Iraq, and Israel is following suit and Lebanon.
What's the end goal here? I mean, if you take just Lebanon, okay, so Gaza, they've reinvaded and been, what, about a year since Israel's pulled out of Gaza, and they're destroying what infrastructure has been built in there. Lebanon destroying the entire country, terrorizing civilians, creating thousands of refugees, and hundreds upon hundreds of people dead. What is the end result that they're looking for, and how do you think they want to achieve it?
If not reoccupy, have a force in southern Lebanon, a buffer force there, and countries are not lining up, by the way, to participate in this buffer force, to make sure that Hezbollah does not come close to Israel, because Hezbollah and Hamas are the two big threats to Israel.
The two big threats to Israel. I want you to expand on that
bit. You know, we often hear that Hamas and Hezbollah are these two terrorist organizations that are threatening Israel, and Israel has to defend itself. But I think it's really important to look at why Hezbollah and Hamas started in the first place. They started in reaction to Israel's occupation of, in Hamas's case, the occupied Palestinian territories, and in Hezbollah's case, Lebanon. And so they grew up, indigenous forces grew up to protect, really, to defend the Palestinians on the one hand and the Lebanese on the other from Israeli aggression. We hear them called terrorists. Hezbollah is a terrorist. But really, I think a lot of people in this world would say that what Israel is doing in both Gaza and Lebanon is terrorism. And it's important to note that even though our corporate media is really walking in lockstep with the Bush Israel policy, that the overwhelming sentiment around the world is against this. 2,000 people marched in Tel Aviv against what Israel is doing, and evidently there are going on many, many more protests, even within Israel, against what's happening.
But to take another step back, you said a couple times that Hamas and Hezbollah are big threats to the Israeli government. That's not been my understanding at all. These are small groups. We're looking at an enormous military capacity and might on the Israeli side, 30 Lebanese dying for every one Israeli.
You're absolutely right, and I should have said perceived threat to Israel, because I agree with you completely. I mean, the fact that Israel built this so-called security fence or wall to protect itself from the Palestinians, which really encroached on much more Palestinian territory and which has created tremendous hardship and anger among the Palestinians, shows this paranoia. I mean, that's another example of this paranoia.
But I don't even think it's born out of paranoia. I don't think it's because they're really scared. They know people who want to get into Israel. If you are living in the West Bank or in Gaza, and West Bank at least, and if you really want to get into Israel, there are ways. Same with Gaza. Now, and people get in all the time, not to commit political violence and harm, but they do it just to survive and to work. The reason that they built that security wall is about land, and it's about a land grab, and it's about isolating Palestinian land from each other, enabling more to be swallowed up into Israel.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And, I think one of the biggest casualties of Israel's recent aggression against the Palestinians in Gaza is that there was a peace plan in the works. Hamas and Mahmoud Abbas had agreed to this, at least in principle, this prisoner's statement where they would not attack within Israel. They would, they would go back to the 1967 borders, and that is really pretty much gone up in smoke. There was a lot of talk about, Hamas doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist. They want to destroy Israel, and in fact, they were backing down from that position just before this recent aggression.
No, I think that's right. As soon as they were moving in the direction of recognition of Israel in some way, Israel basically found that unacceptable and began this war again. I mean, I think that's a very important point.
Yeah, extremely important. It's a perverse position that Israel takes. And I think it's because their grand design is to expand in a Palestine-free area as far as they can get. And I think the United States' grand design is exactly as you laid out, work with Israel to dominate the area and crush any kind of democratic resistance or popular resistance or any kind of potential resistance to American hegemony and Israeli hegemony in the whole Middle Eastern area.
Marjorie, can you tell us, given the inability of the Security Council to fulfill its responsibility under the UN Charter to restore international peace, can the General Assembly step in?
Yes, it absolutely can, and I'm glad you asked that question, Heidi, because there is a procedure in the General Assembly called Uniting for Peace. It's a resolution that the Security Council passed in 1950, and the General Assembly, when the Security Council fails to fulfill its duty under the UN Charter to maintain international peace and security, the UN General Assembly can step in. The General Assembly, which is, by the way, the democratic organization of the UN, one country, one vote, as opposed to the elitist Security Council, which has 15 members, five permanent members, of course, the veto-bearing members who were the victors after World War II. So the UN General Assembly could meet and they could demand an immediate, unconditional ceasefire and withdrawal. And a near unanimous General Assembly would have a major effect on U.S. public policy and policymakers. It could strengthen the peace movement, And I think that what we need to do, I mean, this is all very bleak, but this is something that we really can do concretely, and that is to pressure, it's not going to happen with the United States government, of course, but anyone who has any kind of connections with other governments, because again, all countries are members of the General Assembly, please pressure them to convene the General Assembly and pass a resolution under this Uniting for Peace.
You may
procedure.
Remember this, but in the earlier Iraq War, the second Iraq War, we drafted one. I think the Center for Constitutional Rights, I did. It's up on our website still. And we went, and I actually lobbied tons of people with Greenpeace. We couldn't get one country to bring it to the General Assembly. And the United States sent a note to every country saying, we believe that anyone who brings this to the General Assembly will be acting adversely to the interests of the United States. And that really, it shut up the most progressive countries out there. So I think you have to do it. I think it's the critical thing for legal people and others to really get involved. And I don't know if the Guild has drafted something yet or if somebody's drafted something, but there is one up on the Center website that we drafted, or you can just put it in Google and find it. But I think it's a really important effort.
Right, and we are in the process of drafting one, and you're correct. I mean, the U.S. is very powerful. It blackmails other countries. It blackmails them, over 100 countries, not to turn over U.S. officials to the International Criminal Court to be tried for war crimes. So the U.S. is very, very powerful, and that's what we're up against.
If the U.N. General Assembly acts, we hope that Israel doesn't go and bomb the U.N. base in Lebanon like they did recently after the U.N. was slightly critical. First, they bombed that base with peaceful observers for 7 hours.
And they had been warned 10 times that they were getting close, and they knew exactly what they were doing.
And during the bombing, the U.N. kept calling Israel and asking them to stop. They're attacking a base that had been there for 20 years that they knew full well what it was, deliberately attacking that base. And each time, Israel said, yes, we'll stop, but it continued for 7 hours, and it wasn't until four peaceful U.N. observers were dead that they stopped.
You're right, and the Secretary General of the U.N., Kofi Annan, said that this was an apparently deliberate attack by Israel on the U.N., after everyone came out and was very upset about what he said, not everyone, but people in the U.S. and Israeli government.
Yeah, not everyone. It's really, we're talking about Israel and U.S. standing virtually alone.
Right. Israel said, no, it wasn't deliberate, and so Annan did not actually back down from what he said, but he said, Israel says it was not deliberate.
You've written so much on the subject. How can our listeners access some of your writings?
My writings, I write about once a week, and they almost all come out on Common Dreams and Counterpunch. There's one right now on alternet.org, called Bush's Enemy Du Jour. I think if you look at Alternet, Common Dreams, and Counterpunch, you'll see most of them in ZNet as well.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for joining us today
on
Law and Disorder.
Keep up the great writing. It's really good and the great work.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
That was Marjorie Cohn, a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law and president-elect of the National Lawyers Guild and the U.S. representative to the American Association of Jurists. The Israeli Security Cabinet agreed to expand and deepen its ground attack in southern Lebanon as innocent civilians and communities absorb horrific destruction. Today, we talk with Manhattan human rights attorney Jamil Dakwar. He's an Israeli Arab Christian raised in the northern Israeli city of Haifa and still has family there, as well as Lebanon. Jamil, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Jamil, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm a Palestinian born in Israel. I'm an Israeli citizen as well. I was born in Haifa, city of Haifa. Was raised in Haifa and got my high school education in Haifa and then moved to Tel Aviv University where I got my law degree. I've been very much involved politically and a human rights activist since law school time. And then joined the Palestinian human rights group, Adala, which is the legal center for Arab minority rights in Israel, which is one of the most prominent human rights organizations now active in Israel. And during my time working for Adala for about 4 years, I did mostly impact litigation cases on behalf of Palestinians who are victims of human rights violations, both inside Israel and in the occupied territories, especially in after the second intifada started in 2000, October 2000, where we were presenting a lot of detainees who were rounded up in early October 2000 and also later on trying to raise a lot of issues related to Israel's violations of international humanitarian law in occupied Palestinian territories, including the 2002 April invasion of or re-invasion of the West Bank.
Yeah, you argued in front of the Israeli High Court, which is the equivalent to, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, those had several arguments in different cases. Most of them are very human rights cases where we raised equal protection arguments or cases that we brought where Palestinians were discriminated against by the different U.S. government agencies, whether in budget allocations, whether in language rights. And we had achieved a fairly a good amount of good precedents, which were very rare to get in the Israeli Supreme Court, which was very conservative when it comes to deal with Palestinian, particularly with the occupied Palestinian territories, where there's still very limited success there. As you know, the Supreme Court always do the balancing between, you know, security and human rights. And when it comes to the occupied territories, it's always the security interest and is always the one that prevail in the Supreme Court of Israel. But we try to generate attention to the cases or the situation of the Palestinians in Israel. And we had a great deal of change in terms of the way, generally speaking, people were treating dealing with the Palestinians. But after the second intifada started, it became much more harder to do that as the Palestinians once again were being viewed as hostile citizens, as enemy citizens, again treated as second or even if not third or fourth class citizens in all areas of life. So that most of my work have been doing legal work in Israel, although there's been a lot of also international advocacy that we did before the UN treaty bodies, raising again issues that relate to the human rights violations of Palestinians inside Israel.
You have a very strong basis in international human rights law. What are the most egregious international human rights violations that Israel's committing, both in Lebanon and in Gaza?
Obviously, we're seeing a pattern, the same pattern that we've seen over the years in the occupied Palestinian territory, whether in the West Bank or in Gaza. Also, in the past years when Israel was the occupying power in southern Lebanon, civilians were targeted and were constantly under a policy of collective punishment. That is the most serious, I think, a violation of international humanitarian law. You cannot subject an entire population to treat them in a way that would subject them to punishment because of the fact that there were some violent act came out of that population, whether in the West Bank or Gaza.
Can you expand on that in the specific instances?
In the instances, for example, of home demolitions. We were challenging the policies of home demolitions in Gaza, in Rafah, for example, where as a result of Palestinian militants taking shelter or trying to be where they live, basically, and trying to protect their homes, Israel would come in and basically level all the neighborhoods and basically turn many Palestinians to homeless or displaced persons. The same happened when indiscriminately attacked civilian residential neighborhoods. That happened many places, particularly in Gaza. In fact, that was one of the reasons that a lot of calls for accountability and justified calls for investigating war crimes by Israel has risen, because it was obvious that the targets were residential neighborhoods. You cannot distinguish between a place like that, between a Palestinian fighter and the entire civilian population. The same is happening, unfortunately, in Lebanon, where Israel is attacking mainly civilian targets, mainly in civilian infrastructure. We've seen that with the airport. We've seen that with the electric power station. We've seen that in other places. And the most recent one was, unfortunately, the attack on Qana in the residential building. All the testimonies, all the witnesses that were there said there was no firing of Katyushas. In fact, the IDF Israeli army conceded that there was no firing from that particular building. They said that there was might have been firing from nearby building. And the policy was to attack an entire area wherever there was a Katyusha or any attack on Israel or an Israeli army from a particular area. Meaning, if a village, there is an attack from a particular village, the whole village becomes target, a justified military target, which is a contrary and a stark contradiction to international humanitarian law. You have to contain a distinction between military target and civilian targets, which Israel is disregarding all over the way.
What other types of international law are being disregarded here?
The Israeli invasion now, and they are going in with ground forces. This is basically turning Israel to from a de facto occupying power to an occupying power. When you are controlling the airspace, the sea, when you're controlling also a ground entry to a particular area or territory, you are basically the de facto occupying power. The same situation is actually happening in Gaza. Even after Israel withdrew from last year and was hailed by the international community as doing a major step toward peace, in fact, it only turned Gaza to a big prison, because it continued to be an occupied territory, because Israel continued to control water, land access, and airspace. The same is happening with Lebanon. Lebanon is under a complete occupied territory under Israeli control with U.S. backing. And again, this is not anymore U.S. just supplying weapons. It is also supplying strategic thinking, politically and militarily, how to do that. And it's not a surprise that we see the military analysts here really going up on air, on live, and explaining the very easily and very clearly the Israeli actions. And I think in that regard, this combination is a very fatal one. I think that is shows us that it's not only about Lebanon. What is happening in Lebanon is very tragic, but unfortunately it is a sign of what the U.S. with Israel's assistance is trying to do that particular area in general.
What are they trying to do there, I mean, in your view? I mean, we understand what they've done in Lebanon to a certain extent, but what's the broader picture?
I think there are, of course, behind this war, there were political and military aims or goals. The military aim or goal was very clear: to weaken Hezbollah, if not to eliminate Hezbollah's military capabilities. And the political goal was locally and then regionally. The local one was to try to eliminate, again, politically Hezbollah, to put pressure on Hezbollah from other Lebanese forces, political forces. Some of them are Christian forces that have been traditionally perceived by Israel as allies in the region. However, that didn't work. Although Hezbollah might have been weakened militarily, but politically has only been empowered as a result of the continued attacks. But regionally speaking, the aim, I think, was to send a message, a clear message to Syria and to Iran. Here's, we are neutralizing, we are eliminating one of the major threats that you had used against one of our closest allies to the United States. If we are going to do anything with Iran, Hezbollah will not anymore be able to join that in order to implicate Israel in that. So in a way, there's a sending a message that Israel with the U.S. are capable of improving Israel's deterrence capabilities, military capabilities, sending a message to Syria where we're able to hit deep in your territory, just as the commando unit did in Baalbek. We're also sending a message to Iran that they should be really warned that U.S. and Israel will not hesitate to take a military action. So in regional, that is their target. And in addition to that, of course, there is the Iraq angle. The Iraq angle where you see that the U.S. is struggling with the insurgency there. And the equivalency is very clear. I'm not talking about the Sunni insurgency, but the Shiite insurgency. The U.S. fought against Sadr and Muqtada Sadr and others in Fallujah and others. Similar strategies were being used, you know, bombarding the whole civilian areas, not distinguishing between, you know, civilian or military areas, sending a message that, you know, whether you are Shia or Sunni, if you are against us, you are be categorized as a terrorist organization. You'll be delegitimized. You'll be weakened. If you're standing against our plans in Iraq or in Lebanon or in the region in general, we will hit you hard and we will make sure that you will be eliminated. That's the message and that's the plan. And that's what Rice said, the new Middle East order or the new Middle East.
Israel has a long history with Lebanon. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's a very long history, and unfortunately, it's a bloody history because it's been always increasing the tensions in Lebanon. Israel has been always interested in having Lebanon, which was predominantly Christian, but maybe not anymore, to be the closest ally as a Christian state. And that's why, you know, Israel has been always looking into deeply into the politics of Lebanon and trying to find allied forces that would work closely with Israel in order to secure its hegemony in the region. There was a heavy price paid for that. And we know when Israel, in before 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, how they tried to basically appoint their own president or to have their own allied president and the time, and how that basically fueled the already existing tensions that was a part of the civil war in Lebanon and created a more bloody war when Israel went into Lebanon in 1982 and reached actually the outskirts of Beirut. And that is also when the time when the Israeli forces together with Christian militias, the Falangas, went into the two Palestinian refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila, and in September of 1982, and basically massacred dozens and hundreds of Palestinians in those two refugees. And since then, Israel has been very cautious, actually, about not repeating that mistake of getting too deep into Lebanon. And that's why we've seen that they were trying to figure out a way of attacking Lebanon, deep in Lebanon, without really getting deep inside Lebanon, because during the 1982 Israeli invasion, Israel lost over 600 soldiers. As comparison, by the way, and during the Six-Day War, Israel lost 800 soldiers. People say, well, how come Israel defeated three armies in the Six-Day War in 1967, and how compared today that they cannot defeat Hezbollah? Well, Israel paid a heavy price as far as it's concerned, because 800 soldiers were killed in almost 6 days. So anyway, Israel's policy now has been shifted. Instead of being taking the burden of being an occupying power, instead of going back to south of Lebanon, they try to defeat Hezbollah and to eliminate Hezbollah through airstrikes. And that's why that was the main campaign that they did at the beginning of the first 2 weeks. And they realized that that was not enough. And they wanted to get closer. And now they're starting with the ground troops invasion, which will get them not close to Beirut, but deep enough to make Israel heavily involved and maybe forcing Israel actually to a long rotation combat, meaning that that will be a counterinsurgency from Hezbollah. Unless, of course, multinational force comes in and become the buffer zone between Hezbollah and other Lebanese forces and Israel.
So you think this is about Hezbollah, looking at the destruction that they're doing? That's just a pretext. And we've discussed it here on the show that really there's something else going on.
Absolutely. For Israel's interest in Lebanon, the more defined, clear interest or target is to eliminate Hezbollah, which has been not only a strong militia that fought Israel very badly until 2000, when Israel had to be kicked out of southern Lebanon in 2000, but also created some kind of a more militant politics in Lebanon, becoming a more political a party rather than just an armed group, gave it a lot of legitimacy and became part and parcel of the Lebanese society. So you cannot really eliminate Hezbollah, because Hezbollah is a lot of people who are represented in parliament and actually in the cabinet. You cannot eliminate Hezbollah because Hezbollah is all over the place, providing services, charities, or other ways, people who've been discriminated as Shiite in Lebanon, for example. The same thing was happening with the Palestinian politics, with Hamas being at least viewed as a terrorist organization, and Israel, with the U.S. backing again, was trying to eliminate Hamas, stop funding to the
democratically elected government.
Exactly. And we've seen what the result was. When you take those actions, when you take those policies of unilaterally withdrawing from Gaza without really addressing the underlying problems of the entire conflict, when you unilaterally withdrew from Lebanon, southern Lebanon, 2000, without addressing other problems related to prisoners, Lebanese prisoners, other lands, continue to violate the airspace of Lebanon over the last 6 years, ultimately it's a recipe for additional conflict and hostilities.
You know,
and
to me, that's what's just totally lost here. I read these editorials. There was one fed by Nancy Soderberg, who worked for Clinton and went to the UN. And she talks about, you know, the Shaba farms and occupying part of Lebanon. And no one mentions anything about getting out of the occupied territories. No one mentions in the so-called legitimate press 1967. No one mentions the settlements. No one mentions the Bantustans. No one mentions any of that, as if this thing comes only like about an attack on an Israeli soldier. I mean, it makes you want to scream, because all they're doing is perpetuating this thing forever.
When the relationship of forces is so monstrous, against Palestinians and the Lebanese, and yet I think I don't doubt their sincerity. They probably really believe it. And that's what's so scary, because they're delusional.
Yeah. And especially when, you know, everybody understands that, you know, Secretary Rice has to maybe go to graduate school and learn about, you know, what is the motive of behind creating resistance movements, you know.
Right. I mean, that's...
And that's the underlying thing. If you can't tell, you can't go and try to get ceasefire, whether long-term ceasefire or a short-term ceasefire, because what Rice did actually in the last visit, it allowed the Israelis more time to continue with their attacks,
that's
with their
absolutely.
Aggression. And that by itself is, you know, outrageous, because once you think of, maybe now there is some kind of diplomacy in place, maybe some kind of a political solution, but all he does is going there and basically giving the Israelis what they need is assurances that the U.S. is backing encouraging the Israelis to continue, because that's the message. We don't want Hezbollah. We don't want Hamas. We only want moderate Arab regimes, and we only want moderate forces in the Middle East. And what that means, continuing oppression of the people, taking their rights, and not really fulfilling what people are struggling for. People are really want to an end to the Israeli occupation, whether it's in the occupied territories or other places. And the administration is not interested in solving this problem. It's only interested in keeping the same status quo, as they will either accept the dictates by the Israelis backed by the U.S., or there will be a continuous, perpetuated occupation.
I mean, but if it's not going to be Hezbollah in 20 years, it's going to be some other organization until they really deal with the issues that Israel has to deal with, which is occupation, return, all these important issues.
Condoleezza Rice not endorsing the ceasefire that allowed for the Israelis to kill those 60 people and mostly children in Qana.
Well, I got to tell you, I thought that even though everybody's saying U.S. should impose a ceasefire, U.S. should do this, it's absurd. It's like going to the person who's behind the war saying, do a ceasefire. I mean, it's a correct demand, and we can say, yeah, U.S. should impose a ceasefire. But it's like me spitting into the wind, because they're the people who have basically said, do it, here's a green light for it, and we'll give you a certain number of weeks to take care of business. And after that, we'll come in and we'll say,
weapons.
Yeah, we'll give you the weapons, we'll let it. So you're basically asking the warrior to impose a ceasefire.
Exactly. And that also, it is consistent with the U.S. At least a view and dealing with the United Nations.
Well, I think they're ethnically cleansing 750,000 Lebanese from South Lebanon, and then bombing the roads as these people are trying to flee north. The U.S. stopping food being sent to these people who are hiking up the highway. It reminds me really of the Armenians fleeing the Turks in the First World War with no help from anybody. Just this horrific crime. I believe it was pre-planned by the United States and Israel a long time ago, and they were just waiting.
As a way, had this ready to go, and they're looking for some way to get away with it.
These are forms of genocide. Actually, United Nations, after the Sabra and Shatila massacre, there was a resolution in the United Nations General Assembly that categorized the massacre in Sabra Shatila as a form of genocide. Mm-hmm. When people say, oh, hear the word genocide, oh, well, you can't say that against Israel. Well, Israel can also do bad things, including coming close to a genocide. You know, these forms that we're seeing in Lebanon come very close to forms of genocide, and we have to really stop it now.
You know what I would call it? I think a useful term is ethnocide, what the Israelis did to the native Palestinians, dispersing and just razing, 460-some villages in 1948?
Right. It definitely was an ethnic cleansing in 1948. Over 450 Palestinian villages were leveled. People were deported, including a lot of my family who are now living, part of them living in Lebanon, mm-hmm. and they cannot unite with other parts of the family because of this war.
Jamil Dakwar, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work. Thank you.